Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Brad Meltzer, History Channel host and author of the new book, The Nazi Conspiracy. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. As I record this Too Jewish show, I'm preparing for a Zionist Rabbinical Council mission trip to Azerbaijan and Israel, which should prove fascinating, provided the U.S. air traffic control system actually allows me to get there. Now, I've never been to Azerbaijan or anywhere in the Caucasus, to be honest. Closest I've traveled in that region is to eastern Turkey, but there have been significant Jewish communities in the region for a very long time. There are somewhat mythical traditions that the Azerbaijani Jewish community dates back to the destruction of the First Temple in 586 BCE, but the more likely origins of the current Jewish community there go back only to the 7th century CE, that's still 1300 years ago, long enough to constitute a remarkable run of Jewish history. I'll certainly know much more about the Azerbaijani Jews in a couple of weeks when I return, but I am particularly interested in learning about the mountain Jews, the Tok Jews, who form one of the three or four different Jewish ethnicities there. Probably originally from the mountains of Iran, they are a unique part of the Jewish people. They have their own language and traditions. There's even a town in Azerbaijan in the Kuba region called the Red Village, or the Jerusalem of the Caucasus, which is the only all-Jewish municipality in the world outside of Israel. Although there are a couple of Hasidic towns in Rockland County, New York, that might also qualify. Anyway, a word about mountain Jews. The mountain Jews are first identified in Persia as early as the 8th century BCE, that's 2700 years ago. Gradually, they migrated east, settling in the mountainous areas of the Caucasus. Mountain Jews survived numerous historical vicissitudes, settling in extremely remote and mountainous areas, sort of out of trouble's way, and they were known to be accomplished warriors and horseback riders. Not exactly the characteristics we expect in Jews that come from other areas. Mountain Jews speak a unique language. It's a combination of Semitic origins, that is, Hebrew originally, and Persian dialects. The Mountain Jews are distinct from the Georgian Jews in the Caucasus. Those two groups are culturally different. They speak different languages, have differences in customs and styles in their Jewish prayer. In addition, in Azerbaijan, there will be Ashkenazic communities of Jews. They arrived with the development of the oil industry in the early 20th century, as well as there being smaller communities of Kurdish Jews, Bukharan Jews, and others. It will be very interesting. Frankly, I'm also excited to go back to Israel after the end of the Gaza War. When I last visited in January and February of 2024, it was a difficult time in Israel, in the midst of a harsh war with no clear end in sight. In many ways, Israel, 21 months ago, was a mix of wartime challenges and complete normalcy, but filled with reminders of the horrors of October 7, 2023, and the missing hostages still held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas at the time. I'm looking forward to seeing just how much has changed with the return home to Israel of the surviving hostages, with the destruction of much of Hamas, the defeat of Hezbollah in Lebanon, the collapse of the Assad regime in Syria, and the short but victorious missile and air war with Iran. It will all be, well, fascinating. And so to play us in this morning, here's a sample of Azerbaijani Tok Mountain Jewish music.
خسرگی اگر عشقا میخنده سبخ سبخ مغز و گام میزنه از سکانیش از بچایش دیدرسه هرچی وایی سوره اونه میساخو از سکانیش از بچایش دیدرسه هرچی وایی سوره اونه میساخو ایچی کل آیل لبالا نیمنی ندینج آیل لبالا نیمنی شیرین آیل لبالا نیمنی اصل آیل لبالا نیمنی ندینج آیل لبالا نیمنی شیرین آیل لبالا نیمنی اصل سفره ای مناوا دشته نگر می نگینی که وارا سره دسته ها را دل و ها دانه دست و سخته که یه بده گوزره دسته ها را دل و ها دانه دست و سخته که یه بده گوزره ایچی کل آیل لبالا نیمنی ندینج آیل لبالا نیمنی شیرین آیل لبالا نیمنی اصل آیل لبالا نیمنی ندینج آیل لبالا نیمنی شیرین آیل لبالا نیمنی
That was a bit of Azerbaijani's mountain Jewish music from the Caucasus. I'll fill you in on much more about these communities when I get back in a couple weeks. I'll be here next week too, though. Don't worry. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest this morning will be Brad Meltzer, popular host on the History Channel on TV and author of the fascinating book on a real-life effort to assassinate the leaders of the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union during World War II. The book is called The Nazi Conspiracy. It's great. Meet Brad Meltzer when he joins us in a moment here on Too Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Brad Meltzer is an Emmy-nominated, number one New York Times bestselling author of a series of books. I think like 12 books, if I'm more or less correct. His book, The Nazi Conspiracy, has just been adapted for young readers, The Secret Plot to Kill Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I should also note that Brad is the host of the History Channel TV shows Brad Meltzer's Decoded, Brad Meltzer's Lost History. This is kind of lost history, isn't it? Tell us the origin of the book, the original book.
So this is a story I found about a secret plot to kill FDR, Stalin, and Churchill at the height of World War II. And I found it in the footnotes of all places. I was like, is this real? I don't even know. And I sent it to my co-writer, my friend named Josh Mensch, and it was real.
By the way, that's just a great last name, Mensch. I totally...
That's how I knew that we were supposed to write together, because his last name was Mensch, and I'm like, you know, how do you not pick that as your co-writers?
Absolutely.
I took it as a sign, but just to paint the picture, you know, we're in 1942. Stalin wants the Allies to invade continental Europe. He's getting blitzed. The Nazis had invaded the Soviet Union, and it's decimating. So we start helping them with armaments, but he wanted us to attack from the west, and of course, with eventually the invasion of Normandy. So as 1943 arrives, the big three need to get on the same page. All the logistics, the troop movements, and they need to meet in person about morale and about strategy. The stakes could not be higher. This summit must happen, and FDR is the middleman since Churchill and Stalin hate each other. So the meeting takes place in Tehran, Iran, of all places. FDR flies there. His motorcade is coming down the center of the city. Everyone's waving and craning their neck. They're all excited to see the president of the United States is here. And what no one knows is that in that motorcade is not FDR. It's actually a Secret Service decoy. The real FDR is ducked down and hiding in the back of a beat-up sedan that's racing through the side streets of the city because they're worried there's a Nazi assassin who's about to murder him. And, Rabbi, I just ruined chapter one of The Nazi Conspiracy, but the book was a great bestseller for us, and we had so many people saying they wanted to share the story with their kids and grandkids. So now this is The Nazi Conspiracy, the young reader edition, so that kids who are younger age can actually read it. You know, 9 to 12 years old can read it.
Why is that particularly important now, do you think, Brad?
You know, I think anti-Semitism, of course, we know is at an all-time high. And why are we still fighting that Nazi hatred, that runoff from what happened in 2025? And the reason is because the Nazis never left. We think of the Nazis as being something that happened in Europe or a long time ago, but they were right here. We found, in fact, in the book, you'll see, we found a rally that took place in Madison Square Garden, 20,000 people cheering, and a big swastika on the wall with the giant banner of George Washington. The first speaker at the rally said, if George Washington were alive today, he'd be friends with Adolf Hitler. And why are we still dealing with this today? Because, as I said, the Nazis never left, and we need to fight back against that and teach our kids and grandkids how to fight back against that.
We will talk much more with Brad Meltzer. He, with Josh Mensch, is the author of The Nazi Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, now adapted for young readers, a New York Times bestseller. I think this one is something everybody should get for their adolescents, young readers. And we'll have him back in just a moment on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall and winter. Established 7 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us for Hebrew school, Barn Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night, Saturday morning. Friday night, our Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page for services is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kfetch or a kfel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature, randomly recurring feature of 2Jewish, Zen Judaism. In nature there is no good or bad, better or worse. The wind may blow or not. The flowering branch grows long or short. Do not judge or prefer. Ask only, is it good for the Jews? Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out. Forget this, and attaining enlightenment will be the least of your problems. And finally, our last Zen Judaism idea. Wherever you go, there you are. Your luggage, that's another story. Those were a series of koans on Zen Judaism. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And as happens so often, welcome back. You just had a trip to the Balkans and Singapore, which is they're right next to each other, of course. I'm joking slightly. And you met some interesting people, as always. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, in the most unexpected places, you meet Israelis. And it's not always obvious that they're Israelis. You know, most Israelis that you and I know have a characteristic accent that's a dead giveaway. But the first pair of Israelis I met was a father and son team at the international conference I attended in Montenegro. The name of the conference is Mahar, and it's jointly run by the Montenegrin government, the Jewish agency. The ambassador of Israel made an appearance and unbelievably couldn't speak English, but gave a speech in English anyway. Huh. And for the introductory session, there was simultaneous interpretation, which almost nobody needed because all the speakers were either English, however broken, or Serbian. But this father-son team was using headphones, and they clearly were not connected to anybody there. So at the end of the introductory session, I went over to them and said, where are you guys from? And I learned that they were from Israel, a small town near the northern border, near Nahariya, actually. And they were there because they were exploring their family's roots in the Balkans. I said, oh, what's your family name? Finzi. So the younger one, Yonatan, who's becoming a psychiatrist in northern Italy, somewhere, he's been in med school for 10 years, so he's like late 30s already. Because, of course, he didn't go until he finished his service in the Israeli Navy, et cetera, et cetera. So he tells me that his whole life in Israel, he was teased for having such a weird last name. But in the Balkans, it's very common. It's as common as Cohen. And all my Yugoslav Jewish friends know at least a dozen different people named Finzi. And the Finzi family moved from Spain to northern Italy, where a movie was made long ago that you may remember called The Garden of the Finzi Conti.
Yeah, based in a book.
And then a lot of the Finzis moved on to Bosnia, and from Bosnia they spread to other parts of the former Yugoslavia. So the father and son were amazed to be in a place where their family name was common. and they enjoyed themselves a lot, and I made sure they met lots of locals for their next trip to the Balkans. And then I went on to Singapore to visit a close friend who recently got remarried, and I stayed in my home away from home there, which is the Conrad, on the top floor of which is a little executive lounge. It has a lot of small tables. And at the table, like right next to mine, was two guys talking business, one Japanese and one who sounded midway between American and Canadian. Usually my ear's pretty good and I can tell, but I wasn't sure at all. So when the Japanese guy got up and left, I asked the guy who was left, I said, are you Canadian or American? And he said, neither. Guess where I'm from? I said, well, you have no accent other than, you know, a vaguely North American accent. He said, well, I'm Israeli. I said, can't be. And then he switched into Hebrew to prove the point. And it turns out he's been living in Sri Lanka for the past 15 years. So we bonded over the fact that Sri Lanka has by far the best papayas in the world. And over his shock that of all the people in the lounge, he was sitting next to somebody who spoke fluent Hebrew, and we could converse in Hebrew from that point onward. So that was cool. You know, I won't probably stay in touch with the papaya guy who lives in Sri Lanka, but I will certainly stay in touch with the other guy who's becoming a psychiatrist, and his side hustle is he works as a tour guide in Milano for Israeli tourists, and he loves doing that.
Incredible.
Yeah, and he and I have a ton in common. Like, we both love food and drink and travel, et cetera, et cetera. It was a fortuitous meeting.
It's amazing where you can find Israelis. They say, Kulanu Yehudim, there's Jews everywhere, but there's definitely Israelis everywhere. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Isaac is sitting at a table in his favorite restaurant and calls over the waiter. Yes, asks the busy waiter. Are you sure you're the waiter I ordered from? Asks Isaac. Of course. Why do you ask? Replies the waiter. Because I was expecting a much older man by now, replies Isaac. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish. Just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Chaye Sarah, which marks a transition in our Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards the next generation, featuring Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of Chaye Sarah, we're told of the length of Sarah's life and almost accidentally learn that Sarah has died. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the portion begins, and a famous midrash on it tells us that Sarah was just as beautiful at the age of 100 as she had been at 20, and just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. A fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes from the scene. Chaye Sarah is a portion filled with negotiations that will have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion, someday to be known as Judaism. The first extended section of Chaye Sarah is actually dedicated to arranging Sarah's funeral. Abraham purchases the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will eventually be the land of Israel. That cave becomes the burial place, not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah all find their final resting place in Hebron. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of this plot involves an extended bargaining session with the Hittite guy who owns it, the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the whole world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at an early point in history. You know, I visited Machpelah a couple of times, once many years ago when you could go into the cave itself, and then about 10 years ago when Jews were only permitted by Israeli authorities to go into the area above the cave for fear of creating a violent incident. It's still a powerful place. After the burial at Machpelah, the narrative moves us forward in Genesis with one last important, detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham is old. He sees that his son Isaac is not yet married. Perhaps seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. And so Abraham charges his trusted servant to return to the old country of Sumeria, Haran, in eastern Turkey, just north of today's Syria, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of believers in the one true God. After a long journey and the first extended prayer recorded in the Torah, the servant meets Rebecca drawing water from the city well in Haran. He knows she is the one for Isaac because she shows great generosity and intelligence. He too bargains, in this case with Rebecca's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, Abraham's servant arranges for Rebecca to become Isaac's wife, but at the crucial moment of the narrative, Rebecca's family puts the question to her, "Will you go with this man?" That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? This final negotiation of Chaye Sarah is brief. Rebecca agrees quickly. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. Like Abraham before her, she embraces this call to begin a new life. And so she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism itself is assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rebecca and Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals, and often they still require negotiation to achieve: a secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. They are great goals, and we must continue to work to achieve them. When we come back in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Brad Meltzer, popular History Channel host, shares shocking details about the plot to assassinate Allied leaders during World War II. They're from his book, The Nazi Conspiracy. Find out what those facts are when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohai.
In information that cannot possibly surprise any intelligent person, the Israel Defense Forces published a collection of intelligence documents last week that showed evidence of Hamas's connections to Iran, to UNRWA, that's UNWRA, and Al Jazeera, as well as the terror organization's actions at the deliberate deepening of civilian suffering by Hamas stealing food supplies intended for Gaza's civilians. The IDF released these documents with details of Hamas operatives who were employed by UNRWA, as they like to say there, UNRWA, alongside documents detailing Hamas's use of the UN facilities. The IDF uncovered lists of UNRWA employees shown beside a list of Hamas operatives where the same individuals are present with both civilian and Hamas military, that is, terrorist IDs. That list includes teachers, principals, counselors, and medical staff who all have positions, or had positions, in Hamas's Izzedine al-Qassam brigades, the terror organization's so-called military wing. Some were listed on Hamas paperwork, drawing pay from the UN. Released images show Hamas terrorists inside Gaza tunnels eating stolen humanitarian aid meant for civilians. The IDF also shared an excerpt from a document entitled Basics of Military Engineering Level 3 Obstacles. That excerpt provides al-Qassam, that is Hamas terrorists, with instructions to use civilian buildings as they are considered the best obstacle to defend the resistance. The document highlighted the importance of keeping the fight among the people, that is, hiding behind Palestinian civilians. UNRWA schools are listed specifically as meeting places for Hamas in the supply plan of the South Khan Yunis Battalion. The director of UNRWA operations in Gaza, Ashraf Maad, is featured in several photos in which the site describes them as educating children and indoctrinating the younger generation to follow Hamas's ideology and glorifying the war crimes. The IDF additionally revealed detailed proof of the affiliation between the Qatari state-run Al Jazeera news organization and the Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorist organizations. Documents including personnel lists of terrorist training courses, phone directories, and salary documents for terrorists were all uncovered by the IDF. 15 different Al Jazeera journalists were listed alongside their roles within the terror organizations. Ismail Al-Ghul, a Nukba terrorist who took part in the October 7th war crime atrocity massacres in Israel, is listed among the Al Jazeera journalists. Hamas also had power over what Al Jazeera reported. Probably still does. In 2022, Hamas gave clear instructions on how to cover up a failed Islamic Jihad rocket launch in Jabalia, which resulted in the death of several Gaza Palestinian citizens. Al Jazeera was forbidden to criticize Hamas and told which words to avoid. Later that year, another document contained further instructions on avoiding any criticism of failed rocket launches at all. Instead, Al Jazeera was to support the resistance, quote-unquote, in Gaza. A 2023 document displays another direct connection between Hamas and Al Jazeera. According to the materials, Hamas established an Al Jazeera phone, a secure line, allowing the organization to communicate directly with the channel. Additionally, the IDF shared an August 2022 handwritten memo by the late unlamented Yahya Sinwar, evidence of his direct involvement in planning and the propaganda of terror. The memo contained details of Hamas's invasion plan and its propaganda plan. Sinwar called for graphic photos of point-blank executions, exploding tanks, and soldiers being killed with a knife in order to explode emotions for allies in the West Bank and Jerusalem and to inspire fear in the enemy. The rest of Sinwar's memo outlined plans for the initial hours of the attack, aiming to capture military capabilities and render any IDF response impossible. The IDF also uncovered a document in Gaza displaying clear evidence that Iran was supplying Hamas with financial support. That document refers to funds supplied to families of the quote-unquote dear martyrs in Gaza. Iran's financial support was stated as a fact despite internal Iranian protests over financial aid leaving the country. The document also said Iran was adopting a strategy to develop the Qassam force, giving training, arms, and expertise. Hamas expressed a desire for a four-party alliance with Iran, Hezbollah, and Syria to coordinate efforts of media and tactical political work and military tactics. This alliance, which didn't really turn out to work, was designed to launch an attack that surprises the enemy from all sides in the war to liberate Jerusalem, unquote. A document titled Hamas Humanitarian Aid Intelligence Resources includes evidence Hamas members stored supplies for their own use while civilians were facing shortages on land, that is, above the tunnels. These documents describe conditions in which Hamas fighters are supplied underground, all while Gaza residents above ground had a lack of food and resources. These documents expose Hamas terrorists hoarding stolen humanitarian aid and carelessly handling weapons, the IDF said. They added that while aid continues to enter Gaza now, much of it still does not reach civilians. The IDF found a collection of photos of Hamas exploiting stolen humanitarian aid in tunnels. Fresh fruit and vegetables, canned goods, flour and meat are all on display in the photographs, showing Hamas guys playfully mishandling weapons next to the sacks of stolen humanitarian aid. In other news, the BBC's Arabic news service chose to minimize Israeli suffering in the war in Gaza so it could paint Israel as the aggressor, according to an internal report by a whistleblower. Allegations made against Israel were raced to air without adequate checks, the memo says, suggesting carelessness and a desire always to believe the worst about Israel. BBC Arabic, funded partly by a grant from the British Foreign Office, gave large amounts of space to statements from Hamas, making its editorial slant considerably different from the main BBC website, even though it is supposed to reflect the same values. The BBC also gave unjustifiable weight to Hamas claims about the death toll in Gaza, widely accepted to have been exaggerated for propaganda purposes, and incorrectly claimed the International Court of Justice had ruled genocide was taking place. In very different news, In an unprecedented rebuke, Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid announced last week that his centrist Yesh Atid party is withdrawing from the World Zionist Organization. He accused the 127-year-old quasi-governmental institution of being mired in corruption and political patronage, saying corruption was pushing diaspora Jews away from Israel. Lapid also said he would push to nationalize Keren Kayemet Yisrael, the Jewish National Fund, which controls over 13% of Israel's land. And in America, New York City woke up to a new mayor-elect last week. Jewish groups that spurn Zoran Mamdani face a decision how to react to a leader whose harsh criticism of Israel flies in the face of their core beliefs. Jonathan Greenblatt, the Anti-Defamation League head, who railed against Mamdani throughout the race, convened a briefing to discuss grappling with the new administration. He announced a Mamdani monitor, a public tracker of Mamdani's policies and personnel appointments that the ADL views as threatening Jewish security. "We're deeply concerned about what the next 4 years could augur for Jewish New Yorkers. The anti-Semitic language he has promoted, the anti-Semitic policies he's championed, the anti-Semitic extremists he's known to affiliate with," Greenblatt said. Greenblatt cited Mamdani's support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS anti-Semitic movement against Israel, and terrible rhetoric about the Israeli army as evidence this mayor will not have our backs. Mamdani was elected the city's first Muslim mayor without a majority of Jewish voters, who've split over his brutal criticism of Israel. Exit polls indicate Mamdani won just over 50% of voters, but only 33% of Jewish voters. His pro-Israel opponent, Andrew Cuomo, won nearly twice as many Jewish votes, about 63%. The New York Board of Rabbis and other leading Jewish institutions in the city said, "We cannot ignore that the mayor-elect holds core beliefs fundamentally at odds with our community's deepest convictions and most cherished values." They added they would continue to work with every level of New York government nonetheless. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Brad Meltzer is an Emmy-nominated author. He is the host of two History Channel TV shows, Brad Meltzer's Decoded, Brad Meltzer's Lost History, one of which was used to find the missing 9/11 flag that the firefighters raised at Ground Zero, by the way. His new book, which is really an adaptation of a best-selling book, The Nazi Conspiracy, The Secret Plot to Kill Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. So you told us a little bit about the original plot to kill Roosevelt. You know, Hitler and Stalin were such a weird kind of almost parallel lives pair of people who despised each other and then made the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact. And then, so what was involved in the plot to kill Stalin?
There was going to be, when they first met together, when the big three came together, it was all going to be in one fell swoop. So it wasn't like I'm taking out FDR and then I'm taking out Churchill. He was planning to do it all together. And, you know, obviously the plot got, you know, it never happened. We know what the ending is, not to ruin, you know, no spoiler alerts here.
Yeah.
But the one that this, you know, listen, we all know, as you know, the stories of Stalin, you know Hitler, you know FDR. But the people that I was fascinated with are the people I'd never heard of. There's a Nazi in the book named Otto Skorzeny. And Otto Skorzeny gets a call that he's paged to go to Adolf Hitler's secret hideout called the Wolf's Lair. And when he goes to there, he finds that Hitler has brought together all of his best fighters, all of the best infantry people he's got. He wants to find who the best fighter is. He lines them up shoulder to shoulder in this big open room, and Hitler quizzes them with one question. He says, "What do you think of Italy?" And everyone starts, of course, kissing the rear end of the boss, saying, "Oh, Italy's on our side, and they're our pals, and we're going to, you know, together we'll crush the Americans and the Allied powers." And one dissenting voice screams out in the middle of that, "I am from Austria, my Führer," and it's this Nazi Otto Skorzeny. And what Otto Skorzeny is basically doing is he's gambling, because he knows that Adolf Hitler is also from Austria, and a true Austrian actually hates Italy, because back during the First World War, Italy took a key piece of Austria and never gave it back. And in that moment, Adolf Hitler looks at Otto Skorzeny, and he's like, "You're my guy." you're my guy. And he sends him on this secret mission. I won't ruin this part of the book, but he sends him on a secret mission that's so wild. I wanted my son to make sure he believed what he was seeing, what he was reading about. So I actually put a photograph from that day, from Otto Skorzeny's mission, into the book, because otherwise I'm like, you're not going to believe it. And it's the craziest Nazi plot you've never heard of in your life. And I love the fact that we get to tell this untold piece of history. And the question I'm sure that you're asking yourself is, why do I not know this story?
Right.
And the reason you don't know it is when it first happened, FDR came back and said, yeah, the Nazis tried to kill me. Made the front page of all the papers. But soon after that, in the years that followed, the invasion of Normandy happened. And it bumped this story into the footnotes of history. Nobody cared about it until my buddy Josh mentioned it. I said, hey, maybe we should tell this story.
The obviously, the assassination didn't happen, and people love contrafactuals. It would certainly have changed things. Who knows how? World War II seems to have come back after, you know, it's a long time ago now, 80 years since the end of World War II. Why is there so much more interest now in World War II?
I think part of it, Rabbi, is where we are as a culture. You know, World War II has this distinct, you know, the one distinct detail about it is it's one of the few times in world history where everyone agrees who the bad guy is.
Right.
America stands strong together. We fight the bad guy. We decisively win. Can you imagine that happening today anymore? And I think part of the problem of where we are as a culture is we're so divided. We're so pulled apart right now. And I think the reason why World War II has come back is because we want to see America stand together again. It's, you know, it's a beautiful thing to watch us stand together. And I also think, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, especially on your show, is there's a recipe for authoritarians. And, you know, in Hitler, you have a charismatic leader. And in Hitler's case, you know, he sees these white native-born Germans who are suffering economically. And then he says, those people are the ones causing your pain. And those people, that's the code word. And, of course, Adolf Hitler meant the Jewish people, but we've seen it used against the black community, see it used against the immigrant community. And to me, the American dream is not about making money. The American dream is that when you see someone being bullied and you see someone being picked on, that you use your voice, you stand up and you say, enough already, enough. Because you know that the Holocaust did not start with death camps. It starts with slogans and propaganda and rallies and book bans. And if you don't teach these lessons, I know it's cliche at this point to say we're going to relive it. Forget about we're going to relive it. We're already in it. We're divided. We're not talking to each other. Our families are fighting with each other. And to me, it's disgusting the way we talk to each other now. And don't ever forget, there's a reason why politicians want you angry. There's a reason why social media wants you angry. There's a reason why cable news wants you angry, because angry people vote. And angry people will scroll endlessly on their social media, and angry people will watch and make for great ratings on your cable news. So the next time you're on one of those and you're feeling all angry and mad at the other side, stop a moment and be better than what angers you, and realize that we have far more in common than venomous hatred that pulls us apart.
You know, the World War II is often called the last good war, and the greatest generation fought it. My dad fought in it. It was a war against fascism and for democracy. It is so strange to me to hear people idolizing authoritarianism today in America. How did we get here?
You know, we got here the same way that we got here in World War II. And it's that people are suffering economically and they feel like no one's speaking to them. And it's really easy to point fingers, but people felt like they weren't being heard by our own government. And when they're not being heard, and they're feeling like they're the victims, someone's going to take advantage of that. And that's what happened. That's where we are. And I think what we could do is, rather than pointing fingers and placing blame and saying those people again, is actually listening to each other. Actually saying, why? Who's hurt? What do you need? As opposed to saying, what a jerk, what a dummy, what an idiot. And I think, you know, I do believe to my core, you know, as a Jew and is the way the world changes. I can't change the world, but the way the world changes is you got to change yourself, and it starts with yourself. And that's what I think is the most important thing, is rather than pointing fingers and placing blame, is just saying, I'm going to be a little better tomorrow when it comes to these issues. And if we all did that, I think the world would be in a better place. But man, that's why we are where we are right now, is because we're not doing that.
Takeno Lamba Malchut Shaddai, trying to perfect the world under God's rule, which means perfecting yourself first. Absolutely. Beautifully said. Tell us a little bit about the process of taking a book for grown-ups and turning it into what is essentially a nonfiction YA book.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and the funny part is, sure, we take some of the dialogue, you know, the vocabulary, we make sure it's easily understood by a younger age group, but that wasn't that hard to do. We do take out some of the more, I guess, I'll say, kind of visual, gruesome parts of the Holocaust, but I'm like, I'm a Jew, I'm not taking out the Holocaust from my book. It's in there.
Right.
Where, you know, Ron C. Conference is front and center. Here's this big conference, everyone comes in Germany, they all meet together, they pass out folders, everyone's got notepads, they're taking notes, and instead of talking about building roads or repairing bridges, they're talking about exterminating the Jewish people. And in that meeting, what's so important is that all these people, we want to blame everything on Adolf Hitler, but all these German military, I mean, government workers, none of them say no. None of them stand up and say, what are we doing here? None of them protest. And that's in the book, too. I put it in there, right? I mean, those are the vital parts. So the truth is I think for kids or for adults, you've got to, you know, take the lesson of Elmore Leonard, which is simply that you got to just take out the parts that people skip, and you got to take out the parts that are not appropriate for younger kids. And once you do that, you leave the good parts in, and a good story is a good story. I don't care what the age range is. And you know as well as I know, sometimes you read a young adult book, and you're like, whether it's Harry Potter or The Hunger Games, you're like, man, this is a good book for me too. And I treat it the same way. You know, kids want a good story. I mean, I had so many, you know, I really wanted people to be able to give this book, whether it's as a bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah gift, or whether it's just for, you know, to give to your grandkids, is to give them something that says, here's a good World War II book you're actually going to like. It's not just filled with dates and facts that they're going to roll their eyes at, but it's the shadow of this assassination. And I think there's a reason why I hope kids will really take to it and learn those lessons.
What was the most surprising thing you discovered in writing the Nazi conspiracy besides the secret plot in the first place?
You know, one of my favorite parts is this story about Franz Mayer. And Franz Mayer is this guy, again, no one's heard of him. I'd never heard of him. He's like, again, footnote in history. He's this young guy, and he's one of the people who's hiding in Tehran. He's like an undercover agent. And the Germans give up on him, truthfully. Like, but then when they find out that the big three are going to meet in Tehran, Franz Mayer becomes the ultimate thing that anyone can use. They got a man on the inside. He's been there for years. He's, you know, Nazi sympathizer, hates the Jews, hates what's happening. And now they got an inside man. And my favorite crazy part is Franz Mayer is actually his girl. He's in love with this woman named Lily. He loves this woman, Lily, and he'll do anything for Lily. But what Franz Mayer doesn't know is that Lily's also in love, and she's in love with this guy who's an undercover U.S. military soldier. So while he's whispering all sweet nothings into Lily's ears about what his plans are, she's whispering them right back into the ears of an American soldier. And the whole plot, I won't ruin the ending, but one of the reasons it gets, you know, arguably foiled is because this one guy just wants to impress a girl. Like, and I don't know their names, you don't know their names, no one knows their names, but arguably the fate of World War II is in the hands of these people you've never heard of. And to me, that's not a bad thing, it's a beautiful thing. It's my core belief, Rabbi. I believe ordinary people change the world. I don't care where you went to school, I don't care how much money you make, I believe in regular people and their ability to affect change in this world. And it's why I believe in telling these stories, like the Nazi conspiracy, to your kids, and of course to your grandkids.
The power of this story is in part because, obviously, the conspiracy doesn't succeed, but it's hard explaining the Holocaust to kids, isn't it?
You know what, the funny thing is, I don't think it is. I actually don't. I think kids understand things that are black and white, and the Holocaust is black and white. You know, I do a lot of kids' books. We do I Am Amelia Earhart, I Am Abraham Lincoln, I Am Rosa Parks. And a few years back, I said, I want to do I Am Anne Frank. And my editor was like, you know, should have laughed me out of her office saying, you want to do a kid's book about the Holocaust? Like, how are you going to do that? And I went to the Holocaust Museum, and I got, you know, a good advisor. It's one of the most important books we've ever done. I've had a survivor read the book in a story time. If I name him with I Am Anne Frank, you'll see him read the book and parts of it. It's one of the most important books. And my niece, who was, I think, something like, 6 or 7, 8 years old at the time, read the book with my sister, and my sister was like, she loved this book. She's like, she understood it. We were having a real conversation about the Holocaust that wasn't filled with fear and freaking her out, but what she understood is sometimes people hate you just because of who you are or where you're from. And that's a black and white thought, and kids understand black and white thoughts. So I don't think it's that hard to teach. I think, sadly, for our kids, it's very easy to teach hatred and why it happens. The question, that becomes more complex is, of course, the why question. But in the Holocaust, the why is right there for no other reason than because you're Jewish.
Brad, I want to thank you for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the Nazi conspiracy?
Yeah, go to bradmeltzer.com. It's B-R-A-D, and then Meltzer is like seltzer that you drink in an egg cream. Only on a rabbi show can I make an egg cream joke, but I love it. But yeah, there's Brad Meltzer. It's like seltzer you drink with an M, like Mary. Or you can go to any bookstore. They'll have our books there. But go to bradmeltzer.com. Watch our commencement address that I did at University of Michigan last year. You can read some first chapter of the Nazi conspiracy for free and see a lot about all of our other books. And I really appreciate the time and what you do.
It's a pleasure. And I might add, and you're a Michigan alum, too. So I'm glad they brought you back. Brad, thanks so much. We'll talk again.
Thanks, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, Ghetto Final Musical Playout.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be our good friend, Richard Michelson, author of the new book, What Louis Brandeis Knows, A Crusader for Social Justice Becomes a Supreme Court Justice. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Odea, of Moroccan Jewish descent, who has moved towards more Jewish observance. It's her version of the song Hakol Hakol LeTova. It's all for good. My friends, may you enjoy a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace. שלווה ורוגע ושמונה ילדים מגיע לי מה שיש לאחרים התפילה שלי מנפצת שערים מגיע לי ארגזים מיליונים שפע סביבה עוטפת וכל חבר בצבע בריאות הנפש סיבוב לבד בטבע לראות אותו עם תפילין כל יום בשבע יש עניין, תשמעו על זה בסוד איך לגרום לאלוקים לאהוב אותנו עוד אם נשבר לך הלב תקום לרקוד כי יש עניין ש... יש עניין ש... יש עניין שנתהפך הכל הכל לטובה יש עניין שנתהפך הכל לטובה יש עניין שנתהפך הכל הכל לטובה יש עניין
Too Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.